My title has changed in transit, and so did my name. I'm Boris Schiffman, and yes, it does. Well, doesn't it say on top? Yeah, Schiffman. So in any case, but more importantly, it's much more important to get the names of my partners in this enterprise, and Misha and Alain both here. And the subject of my talk is a phenomenological model of velocity statistics based on Lagrangian dynamics. But I will start with a general advertisement for the merits of proceeding beyond the traditional 1 and 2 point statistics and looking at more complex objects, studying multi-point statistics. And then I'll proceed with an attempt at statistical closure in terms of 4 points, hence a tetrad model. And I'll introduce it and describe the philosophy and that goes into it and the physics. And then I'll present some of our results. And this is very much work in progress. So, oh my God, this is dangerous. And of course, the goal of this whole exercise is, as Itamar said yesterday, to gain some physical insight into the physics that is underlying non-Kolmogorov effects in integrals. So here's the flashback to a passive scalar, you know, just like Zelman. I have to start the talk with a passive scalar. So there for the Creighton model, which Itamar described yesterday, one can write down basically exact evolution equations for multipoints of simultaneous multipoint correlators. And that evolution operator derives basically from following constellations of observation points along the Lagrangian trajectories and then averaging over realizations of random velocity that's carrying them along. And now this produces a nasty multidimensional PDE, but the point is that it's the only game in town, because even if you're interested in high moments of a two-point difference, no exact equation can be derived for this object, and one has to actually go back to following endpoints and then bringing them, fusing them together in some particular way. But on the other hand, once you invest the labor in solving for this multipoint object, you can learn more than its general scaling behavior, because this multipoint statistics is like a snapshot of the field, and we can start gaining a little bit of insight about the structures that are underlying these large fluctuations. For example, the ramps and cliffs that Zelman described in his talk, and I could have just gone on and talked about that, but for better or worse, my real subject is not passive scalar, but an active vector, and we're interested in a statistical description of the velocity field, and of course, quite generally, this would be given by some probability distribution functional, which would be advanced in time by a transition probability matrix corresponding to Navier-Stokes. Now the problem with this is that in this new century we're not any better at dealing with these functional equations than in the last. And we would like a much simpler description in terms of velocity measured just at a small handful of points. And Victor, I think later today, is going to talk about his attempt at constructing a two-point closure. But we argue that a natural object for a closure is a four-point object. And the reason is that natural dynamical quantity is strain and vorticity, and it takes a velocity measurement at four points to reconstruct the velocity gradient tensor, sort of coarse-grained over this object. And then what we would like to do is construct some probabilistic description of evolution of the shape of this four-point object and of the velocities that it carries along. So coarse graining was the key word. Sorry, it is running. Yeah, it's a lubrication approximation. Yeah, well, it will happen again. I'm going to invest. So, anyway, coarse graining was the key word. So in order to coarse grain, let's actually consider not four points, but a whole swarm of points, and then try to decompose their velocity into the center of mass, which we don't care about. The best fitting linear velocity profile. So we're basically going to fit a linearly varying velocity field by least squares, and that will define the coarse grain velocity gradient matrix here. And whatever doesn't fit will lump with small scale velocity fluctuations. So that cleanly defines our relevant dynamical object. And another relevant dynamical object we're going to construct basically as a tensor of inertia for all these bunch of points. And together, these two tensors correspond to degrees of freedom of this tetrad, except for now it's sort of a virtual tetrad, which somehow fits in here. And I'll go back to they're basically reduced coordinates. They probably should have been ours. Well, of course, the size of the swarm is one of the dynamical variables, right? And so that's a very important point. It's basically the radius of gyration of the swarm is just a trace of this matrix. Okay, so we can go back to Lagrangian dynamics that featured in Eberhard's talk. And so local accelerations are given by gradient of pressure and perhaps local force. And we can quite explicitly write down dynamical equations for our tetrad variables. And basically what we're doing here is lumping all the terms with these variables on the left. So, for example, this describes the distortion of the shape of a tetrad by action of the strain. This is the contribution of that a little bit of jiggling small scale velocity that we had. The nonlinear term in the M equation describes the stretching of vorticity by the strain. That's the crucial nonlinearity. Then what we've done is we've split the pressure into two pieces. The local part, which is needed to enforce incompressibility or tracelessness here. So the traceless non-local contribution. For what it's... They're somewhat schematic. They're simplified. No, they're not schematic. This, in fact, is... There are some variables that I didn't bother defining in detail here, right? This is completely explicit. And what's explicit here is that this local pressure is anisotropic. It depends on the shape of the tetrad, the shape of the swarm. So for what it's worth, these equations are exact, but they're not closed because here on the right-hand side we have non-local pressure and the small-scale stuff that we know nothing about. At this stage, we're going to make a draconian approximation. We're basically going to say that the interaction with the other little correlation volumes in the fluid contained in here are properly randomized and can be described on the Gaussian level, by Gaussian random variable. We'll say the same about the small-scale velocity. We'll estimate the variance of these Gaussian variables using Kolmogorov dimensional analysis and our available dimensional constants here. So this velocity is to build in Kolmogorov scaling of typical fluctuations, right? That's what we're doing by sticking in all these Gaussian noise terms. We're also willing to impose the overall energy flux, because you may have noticed that there was no viscosity in the equations that appeared so far. And the reason is we're working in the inertial range, we don't need to worry about the viscosity, but what we need to get straight is the energy transfer to small scales, which enters, as in von Karman-Horvath, through a correlation of stress, a stress tensor with the strain. In our notation, this turns into this following third order correlator of the M field. And we'll be willing to do what it takes in the model, i.e. twiddle various parameters that we have, to make this object independent of scale, i.e. constant. And having built this Kolmogorov behavior of typical fluctuations described by low moments, we'll be interested in studying the statistics and scaling of large fluctuations due to the nonlinear dynamics that we kept locally in the description of the tetrad. Ultimately, what we want to do is take this in a logical model and go back and forth between the model and direct numerical simulation and see whether we're on or off the track. So what's happening in this model? Let's first look at the deterministic component of the equation. Now, our M field and this shape tensor when looked at in three dimensions form an 11-dimensional phase space. So it takes a little bit of projecting to see what the dynamics is. And the good variables are invariants of this M tensor. The second invariant, which traditionally for some reason is defined with a minus sign for which I'll take no responsibility. And that is basically vorticity squared minus the strain squared. And the third order invariant, which boils down to strain skewness minus entropy production. With some coefficient, which Arkady knows. okay, so now in that plane, suppose we start with a little isotropic tetrad, so a regular tetrahedron. So this moment of inertia tensor is proportional to our identity. And we release that thing and compute invariance in the next time slice, and that will define a flow for us, or which is really tangent to the real flow. And it's quite simple. There is a separatrix here which actually separates the hyperbolic and elliptic regions. Hyperbolic means real eigenvalues of M, elliptic means complex eigenvalues of M. And if you start in this left half plane, you flow to this lower right quadrant. No. Well, this is really. This is instantaneous, right? So it is just M dot, right? And it's tangent, right? And it's a cut through a real flow. So it's actually a very important point. Well, no. This is just No, that just refers to eigenvalues of this M matrix, M tensor. I'm running out of quarters. Okay, this sort of flow has been seen before in amusing context. So if you take a good old Euler equation and take a gradient of it, you'll derive an equation for velocity gradient of this form. And on the right-hand side, there'll be this second derivative of the pressure, or pressure Hessian. And again, we're Lagrangian, so we've absorbed the convective term. And Mr. Viefos, about 20 years ago, made the following brave approximation for the pressure. He just assumed pressure to be locally isotropic, and incompressibility takes care of the rest, and then one ends up with a closed equation for this velocity gradient tensor, and I'm calling this little m to distinguish it from, because this is honest to goodness derivative, and I really want to distinguish it from coarse grained object here. So in any case, you end up with a particular simple bunch of ODEs, which define exactly the same flow in the space of invariants. And you integrate it trivially, and you find that everything flows off to this lower right corner in finite time. And that's Vieffo singularity. And what I have not mentioned is that if you look in a little more detail at the eigenvalues of the strain, you'll find that in this region, which corresponds to actually negative skewness, there is one contracting direction and two expanding directions. And so Vieffo singularity then corresponds to a blowout in this configuration. And as a model of finite time or an argument for finite time singularity, it didn't do so well with the experts, most of whom are here in the audience. But a little later, Cantwell and co-workers and Baru and Orzag just computed the probability distribution function of these invariants in a numerical simulation, and curiously found that that PDF had a tail, and the tail sort of extends along the Vieffo's tail. So of course, this says nothing about the singularity, but it says that this sort of flow is not completely crazy. But nevertheless, clearly there is a problem with this Vieffo's model, because it does generate finite time singularity. Well, what's different between that and the Vieffo's model? Well, we're working in the inertial range. Whereas the velocity gradient was at the point, our object is defined, our object has shape. And we have this shape dynamics, G. And having this extra local shape allows, in fact, dictates a non-trivial, anisotropic model of the pressure. And then what happens is the following. I hope you can see this. We have to, when we start off along the streamline, we have to worry about what's happening to the shape. So if we start off here, okay, the flow is converging in one direction, diverging in two, so this object will be turning into a pancake. And this will be happening rather rapidly, and even if the isotropic model for the pressure was good initially for this isotropic object, very soon, as distortion grows, it will become bad, and will basically come out of this regular tetrad plane, and the effect of that anisotropy is going to regularize, so cut off the singularity. The flow actually reinjects and comes back to the origin. So instead of singularity, we have a tendency towards formation of sheets or pancakes or ribbon. Now, if we look in on the other side here, the structure of the M matrix is well, has I'm sorry, eigenvalues of strain have one stretching and two compressing directions. And a regular tetrad, which starts off here, turns into filament. And remember that this is an elliptic region, so there's swirling. So what's happening here is really formation of vortex tubes. So the amusing thing in this diagram where we condition on the invariant is we're sort of starting, we're beginning to dissect that proverbial elephant, and so we can look separately at regions of convergence and sort of sheet formation and the strongly stretching regions. So, let's see, I'm supposed to be done already, right? Okay. Okay. So this was deterministic. More properly, we have to include the fluctuations. So we started with what looked like a Langevin equation. We can turn it into a Fokker-Planck equation, which describes the transition probability in a given time from sort of one configuration to another. And we can argue that the Eulerian probability distribution function is a stationary point of that evolution operator. And all we have to do now is specify the boundary condition on integral scale. So we'll just say that their PDF is Gaussian, and in principle we can go ahead and solve for this probability distribution function. And to yes, yes, it comes through this boundary condition. And to help us in solution, we have some path integral representation where we start off on the integral scale and then follow the tetrad along. So in principle, this is all straightforward. In practice, it lives in 11-dimensional space, and we've been sorting it out for 2 years now. And we still have not really gone beyond sort of very qualitative sort of results, but there's a whole bunch of interesting objects that we can begin to calculate. So we can try to calculate that PDF of the invariants, but we can also look at distribution of all kinds of interesting objects such as vorticity or vortex stretching in the RQ plane, and energy transfer, and even get a glimpse of where anomalous scaling is coming from. But in the remaining 2 minutes, I'm just going to flash two pictures. So one is the distribution of entropy production in this RQ plane. As I, maybe I should put that slide back.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you. Exactly. So, as I already argued on that slide, in this region, I would expect vorticity to be aligned with a dominant stretching direction, and indeed, this is where the vorticity is produced. Now, amusingly, as the trajectory swings into this half plane, the sign of the strain reverses, and the vorticity finds itself aligned with the contracting direction, and the filament basically implodes. So you see negative entropy production. However, eventually it realigns with the intermediate direction of the strain, and in this what used to be Vieffos tail, you have essentially formation of a vortex sheet. And so this is what we calculated in the model, and this is what comes out of Alain's direct numerical simulation for exactly the same object. And another picture is energy flux density. So that, I argued, goes as the stress-strain correlation, or this third-order tensor. What we're seeing here is that most of energy transfer lives in the region of sheet formation, this collapse towards sheets, whereas vortex stretching contributes relatively little. And again, this is a comparison with numerical results. And as a bonus here, you also notice that there are these two sectors here and there where actually the sign of energy transfer is negative. And we get the two, and this basically corresponds to a sort of negative energy flux in this region corresponding to implosion of columnar vortices. Well, that is basically laborious construction of probability distribution in the model, which is done by, well, in the new improved version, by basically Monte Carlo sampling of the path integral of the type actually employed in Nice. Okay. I'm done. Let me just put up this conclusion slide and just say that we're cautiously optimistic about what can be learned in this simple model. I think one can really get one's hands on some interesting geometrical objects. We clearly have a great deal to do. Our program was to have quantitative, not qualitative, comparison with DNS. And last but not least, I want to emphasize that it would be nice if one could also get a head start on experimental measurements of these multi-point velocity correlations. And I just want to emphasize that these things are interesting quite independently of what our model says and does. It is interesting to what we've learned here is that these conditional RQ statistics really helps to dissect and distinguish between different geometric structures in the flow. Yes.
I have a note to some of the law and provide it. That model would not be good. You have to keep N as a target here in your presence and for the specific role that is delivered. That's the first problem. I have a note to some of the law and provide it.
Well, I actually do not quite understand that, because we can certainly by hand construct a configuration with isotropic pressure which will be perfectly incompressible and satisfy this thing. Of course, it will have infinite energy and et cetera, et cetera, but I don't see how you can prove that there is no such thing. Good. So maybe then I don't have to answer. Well, no, but now you can. We should talk about that. But right, we're basically would argue that you can condition on basically the invariance of the M tensor, which you can measure in your numerical simulation, and just look in that regime. That's it, right? So now, right, and to the extent that Alain has done the simulation, right, we know that energy transfer sort of lives in that region. The question remains whether, if you like, points with the appropriate signature of M are organized into sheets, right? So if you highlight these sheets, right, if you highlight those points in your simulation, you will see sheets.
This is not new. That you've told us this in 56.
I just have a question. What do you think of the model in the time? How do you know what are the laws to do? Say, how do you go from the end of the R phase to the concept of the correlation time? Or how do you do it?
Well, you know, just as we do it, we calculate some interesting correlators, and now we can. Wait. We've defined these objects as they stand. Now we can study scaling, right? We have not done that. Well, we have to calculate these objects as a function of scale, and see, you know, how, right? And see how, you know, this tail gets longer, or how this gets fatter, and from a solution of some baby approximation to this dynamics, what we're getting is the different scaling along this line, different scaling across, and the third scaling out there. So one can calculate the whole lot. We'll see if it will come out right or wrong.
Two more questions.
Can I have any sort of statement for this? Can I maybe relate to the difficulty in trying to how to formulate the case of the non-factory in the year as well?
Well, most of those 2 years were spent actually on the semi-classical approximation to this, which would have been analytic, but maybe one day it will be, but it isn't there yet.
So the fact that there was
Yeah.
Suppose we had a bound of sheet, a tightly bound sheet, closed. Where would it be on your line? Would you be able to distinguish it from other sheets?
Well, it depends on what scale. It depends on what scale you're looking at. If you're looking at the scale big compared to your wall, you'll see it as a tube. And if you look at the scale comparable to one of those, you know, jelly roll sheets, well, you'll see it as a sheet. It depends on scale. It depends on scale. On the Kolmogorov scale. So then it would look like a sheet. Well, it depends where, right? If it's in the sheet, it'll look like a sheet. Right, so if you're on the Kolmogorov scale, right, it will be varying rapidly, right, and it will depend on whether you're going through the sheet or in between, right, and. I'm missing something. Yeah. That's the best kind of an argument.
We're going to hear more about tetrads, geometry, and dynamics. Thank you very much.